Welcome to Mobility Matters. I'm Tyler Reeb, Director of Research and Workforce Development at the Center for International Trade and Transportation. On May 25th, 2022, I moderated the keynote session for the International Urban Freight Conference in Long Beach, California. The panel, titled From Invisible to Essential, Covering Supply Chain Challenges, explored changing public perceptions of the supply chain and how media professionals are changing or not changing their approach to covering the topic. I was joined by Samantha Masanaga, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, Sarah McGregor, LA Bureau Chief and Editor of Bloomberg News, and Dan Ronan, Associate News Editor for Transport Topics and host of Transport Topics Radio on Sirius XM. Together, we discuss changing public perceptions about the importance of supply chains and their value to local communities and economies. Check it out.
Good afternoon, everybody. One of the things I like to do when I organize a panel is get exceptional guests, because then I don't have to worry about the quality of what's going to be discussed, and there's very little prep time. And that's what we have today. We have three outstanding media professionals, leaders in their field, who can help me dig into the changing perceptions in the public of the global supply chain, and also share from their professional standpoints, which are each unique, how that has changed pre-COVID-19, during the quarantine, and afterward, in the aftermath. What does it mean? How do we report on something as complex as the global supply chain? I used to be a journalist. It was my first love as a career. I edited, at one point, the Long Beach Business Journal, and I had an opportunity to learn all about the Long Beach-Los Angeles port complex, the largest of its kind in the country, the extraordinary amount of goods that come in and out, and also got a broader sense of how all of these global trends impact a community. What I learned at that point was it's not an easy topic to cover. And I think what we've all learned now as readers, as consumers of the media, is this is a difficult thing to get your brain around. So as I mentioned, we've got three great guests who I'll introduce in a second who can help me unpack all of that. Immediately to my right, we have Dan Ronan. We have Samantha Masanaga, and then we have Sarah McGregor. Sarah is the LA Bureau Chief of Bloomberg. Samantha is a staff writer at the LA Times, and Dan Ronan is the editor and a business reporter for Transport Topics, which is an online journal that focuses on the trade and transportation industry. You host a radio program of the same name on Sirius XM. So we've got a great lineup, so let's get into it. What I experienced, and I'd like if each of you could share your perspective, was pre-COVID-19, the general public and all of us experienced a supply chain dynamic that involved the equivalent of flipping a light switch. You order something, you flip a switch, it's on your doorstep the next day. No thought about any of the sausage making involved. During the quarantine, mayhem, panic. Suddenly, in a matter of days, everybody in every grocery store line in America knows the term supply chain. And as we all talked about earlier, there was a tremendous amount of pressure on media professionals just to respond to the dynamic, the casualties of COVID-19. These were some incredibly traumatic times, as we all know. And in the aftermath, what have we learned? And how has it changed, and how do we responsibly cover something as complex as the supply chain? So Sarah, if you could start us off, pre, during, and post, what are your thoughts, what's changed, and what has not changed for you?
Okay, thank you everyone, and it's so great to be here in person, to be out of my house, to be out of the office, and be eating lunch with a group of people, so thank you so much for inviting me. I guess I'd go sort of way back pre-COVID. For 10 years, I worked in Africa as a journalist in different African countries, and that's where I got my first really close-up look at the supply chains and really the starting point of them, the African farmer, the mining companies, the raw materials that sort of feed the global supply chain. Whether I knew it or not, you know, that is what I was covering. And I moved to Washington, D.C. in 2015, and I was the head of this newly formed trade group. For the first time, we had a trade editor, myself, and a trade reporter. Obviously, that team quickly grew under the Trump presidency with the trade wars. And at that time, we were covering it very much as trade, tariffs, a political issue between the U.S. and China. But under that was hints of a supply chain crisis perhaps underway that we've seen unfold, obviously, over the past couple years. You know, we were covering the ports in so much as we were writing about the fact that companies were pulling forward their inventories trying to avoid tariffs. And that's where we started talking to people like Jean Soroka, Mario Cadaro, you know, at the various ports, trying to figure out why there were these changes in cargo volumes coming through the ports. But again, we were very much covering it more as a political issue and a macroeconomic issue of trade. I moved to LA for personal reasons a few years ago, and I thought I'd left that trade beat behind me. It was a new presidency with Biden. It was obvious it wasn't going to be as big of an issue in his presidency. But lo and behold, COVID came, and where does the supply chain crisis, you know, it was ground zero at the ports just outside of where we're sitting right now. And so I found myself once again sort of thrust into this role of trying to make sense of what was happening. And as much as there was sort of chaos that I'm sure you all experienced amongst yourselves, it was like that for us too. I think we, as a financial press, very much covered before the past couple of years the production of goods, sort of the goods, where they were being made, what was being made, and the end point, which was the consumer who was buying the goods, who was profiting from that, but not the middle ground, which was the freight companies, the you know, cargo flights, the supply chain, everything in the middle. And we quickly came together. Luckily, we sort of have thousands of journalists from all over the world and managed to pull together our coverage. And now I think we're in a much better place. We're able to kind of put together all the linkages across the chain, and we realize that the logistics industry is 8% of the global economy. This is something we need to take seriously. So, you know, our coverage, we have a trade czar right now in London. He's in charge of coordinating globally all of our coverage. We have a newsletter, and we cover it on all of our platforms, TV, radio, podcasts, you know, the whole Business Week magazine. It's one of our top themes, I'd say. So I'll leave it there because I know we have a lot more to talk about, but that's a short history, I guess.
Thank you, Sarah. Samantha, you at one point did cover the supply chain, and you've since transitioned into a focus on who's left behind due to the COVID-19 crisis. Very curious to hear about your thoughts on your evolution in terms of your coverage, but also what you've seen from that vantage point.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me. Way before the pandemic, I was covering the aerospace industry. So looking at commercial space, drones, defense contractors. And once the pandemic hit, for our business staff, which is a bit smaller than it used to be, it was kind of all hands on deck. So anyone who had a beat that was not immediately related to what was going on economically with the pandemic started doing a little bit more on topics related to that. That's how I ended up with the supply chain beat. I wanted to really look at how this was affecting consumers and tried to really focus that on just everyday readers. So I looked at stories about the oxygen shortage. I did stories on the coin shortage. And kind of around that time, I transitioned my beat into a little bit more general. It was looking at how COVID had affected the economy and who was being left behind. And I started doing that with that coin shortage story, looking at who is really affected by a coin shortage in ways that are really dire. And what that ended up being was folks who didn't have a bank account. If you don't have a bank account, you don't have a credit card, that makes a coin shortage even more difficult, because if you use the cash and coins you have, and you don't know if those restaurants or laundromats or grocery stores have the change to give back to you, that's a huge problem. So that was a little bit of the transition into looking at who was being left behind. And so when I was looking at supply chain stories, I was really trying to see who is being affected that is not getting a lot of coverage. So beyond the coin shortage story, we looked at how calf-producing ranchers were being affected by beef prices, how their cattle were going through a bottleneck, and they were concerned that they were not going to be able to get as much for them as they had paid for them. And that's sort of how I've continued my coverage today. You know, I'm still covering how COVID is affecting the economy and those being left behind. And I'm really trying to make sure that I'm focusing on those folks that are not getting as much coverage or getting as much attention in that space.
Thank you, Samantha. Dan, you started your career as a general interest reporter, and then over time, you really zeroed in on transportation. Mm-hmm. So I'm very curious to hear about your pre, during, and post thoughts on covering this issue.
Well, TT, because we're a specialty publication as compared to the LA Times or Bloomberg, I assume that all of our readers are in the transportation sector in one form or another. So they understand, you know, there's a certain understanding. If you're reading ttnews.com or you're getting the print publication, you understand because you're a transportation professional. But what I'm finding now is that a lot of our readers are folks that have become interested in this topic, and the feedback I get and phone calls and emails and the LinkedIn messages and the like, I get a lot of stuff from people who aren't in the industry. And they want to know more about it. They want to know why it's a big deal that Los Angeles and Long Beach are going to move, you know, close to 2 million containers a month, you know, 1.9 million containers a month. They want to know why. And these are not folks like you folks in the audience. They're folks who maybe, you know, just they've heard about it, they're interested in it. And so I have to think about that now when I'm writing my stories and when I'm doing the radio show. I have to think to myself, okay, my audience is not just the men and women in this room. It may be a banker. It might be some guy who I exchanged emails with or had a conversation with him in the grocery store. So that's sort of changed my perspective of it. The other thing is that working from home has been a little weird. I mean, newsrooms are really fun, dynamic places. Reporters are some of the craziest and most interesting people you'll be around. And to not have that daily interaction with my colleagues, where you just, you know, I go from upstairs, from the upstairs part of the house to the downstairs, it's disconcerting. It took a couple months to sort of figure out the whole lay of the land. You know, as I was telling you before, it's not uncommon in a newsroom environment with a bullpen area or with offices to go into your colleague's office 3, 4, 5 times a day and bounce ideas off of them and say, well, what do you think about this or this quote or whatever it is? Now we don't do that. Now we're sort of all independent contractors on our own, and you don't have that back and forth. So I find that I have to work the phones a lot and stay up to date on emails and the like, but that's just part of the job. But it's just losing that, there's an advantage to working from home. It's a 15-foot commute, but there's a disadvantage that you lose that interaction that you have with your colleagues, and it sometimes you can become a little myopic, and you tend to get kind of narrow-focused and go down a rabbit hole sometimes, I found.
I think that probably everybody in the room can relate to what you're saying on some level, and it's one of the reasons I personally am very glad, and I hope the quarantine days are behind us. You mentioned feedback from readership. I'm curious, what are you all hearing from your readers and your listeners? What kind of feedback have you gotten, and how has that impacted the way in which you've done subsequent reporting?
I think they like it. I think they like the fact that, you know, that there are reporters who have become subject matter experts, as I think the three of us have become, that we understand this stuff, that we drill down and we can talk and understand the stories. I think that they appreciate that and that they like that. And so it's a specialty, it's an unusual specialty to be a transportation and then not just a transportation guy, but a ports and a trucking and a railroad guy. It's a really, you know, niche on top of a niche on top of a niche. And I think the readers, the ones that I talk to, seem to respect that. They seem to think that we're doing a good job. And I get ideas for stories all the time from people who will find my email or shoot me a note or whatever it is, and they'll say, well, what about this? You know, have you looked into this? And sometimes the best stories I get are from readers or listeners who have sort of sent me on a path and I can go down that road. And there's been numerous stories during the pandemic, as I'm sure both of my friends here have had, that have come from folks who have just said, you know, this is kind of an interesting story. I know you do this. Why don't you look into this?
Hmm. Have you found that, Samantha?
Yeah, I think what we found during the pandemic is folks really liked reading more explainers, especially when it came to the supply chain, and really breaking down the larger complex topics that they're reading about. So one of the ways we tried to address that was writing a story, I worked on this with one of my colleagues, John Healy, of following one container all the way through the supply chain. And this actually came from his own experience. He is an avid board game enthusiast and got an email saying that the board game you ordered is gonna take a lot more time because of some supply chain snafus. And he thought, that's really interesting. You know, this is a really visceral way to understand how this works. And so what we did was we illustrated both with design as well as kind of writing this in a kind of step-by-step way of how this shipping container that had the board game that he had wanted to buy went through, you know, starting in China, you know, it's going on the ship, here it's at the port, here's the snafu at the port, now we get the container off the port, how long does it take for the container to get onto the truck, where does the truck go next, all the way back to the distribution center, and then, you know, shipped to the customer's home. And that was something that readers really liked and that really resonated with them, just kind of understanding, okay, I know that it's taking a lot of time for me to get, you know, whatever product to my house. Here's actually what's going on, and this is why this is happening. Now I have a better sense of that. And that's something that I think we're still trying to integrate into a lot more of our stories.
Different ways to tell the supply chain story visually, in a way that makes data come alive.
Right, right.
Most of us would, in the audience would agree that visual renderings, infographics can be incredibly powerful tools in telling a story. Going back to feedback from readers and constituents, how has that played out at Bloomberg?
I guess the number one indicator of if you have a story that interests people is the readership that you get. And Bloomberg, you know, we can measure that through the terminal that we have or through website hits. And obviously, like our supply chain stories, you know, interest in those are through the roof. I mean, the tricky part of it is that because we didn't have a lot of internal, you know, a huge brain trust at Bloomberg on the actual issue of supply chains, we have specialty reporters covering individually covering the Walmart reporter or the government reporters in China covering lockdowns. We have our Tesla reporters. So, you know, we knew what individual companies were telling us or the situation in the countries where goods are being manufactured or the people we could speak to at the ports, but we really relied on people like at the university to explain to us, you know, some of the lingo, some of the actual mechanics of how the supply chain works to nuance our stories in a proper way. And I think it was then upon us, and we just continue doing this day after day to try to, you know, write stories that explain that to the reader. You know, we don't get too into the weeds. We don't want to be blinded by our own expertise when we write stories, but try to explain, and this is why it matters. You know, this is why it will mean as a consumer you might be paying more. This is why inflation's at a 40-year high. You know, trying to connect those dots, but first understanding ourselves, you know, what those are. It was a bit of an education, I suppose, for us. Just today, as an example, you know, we had an editor at the top of the company say, like, oh, are there labor talks going on at the West Coast ports? Are we covering this? And we were like, yes, we've been covering these extensively. But it was just a check to ourselves to say, you know what, we should write an explainer. Like, what is going on with these talks? What are the biggest issues? You know, we've covered them in bits and pieces, and we published a piece that sort of, it was almost like a Q&A style of like, you know, what's automation about? Why is that a big issue? Running through the history, why it would be a big deal if there was a strike or a go-slow operation, if the talks falter. And, you know, that's gotten a lot of readership. And I think it's always taking that step back. Can we do it visually? Can we explain to the reader, you know, at different inflection points, why this matters?
It makes sense. I want to get to the audience. I know that I'm very curious to hear what a room full of subject matter specialists will ask in a format like this. So all of you out there be thinking of questions because I'm eager to go to the Q&A. But before we do that, I'd like to hear from each of you trends that you think are worth following. Trends in research that maybe don't relate to technology but relate to issues connected to equity. I think that our mobility systems in this country are inextricably tied to social mobility, and I think that's something that's worth studying. Policy trends to follow. Opportunities for industry to innovate. It's a wide open question. Dan?
Just 6 months ago, the Congress finally and the President got together on an infrastructure bill. $1 trillion. And a large chunk of it's going to be spent here in the state of California. Pretty good chunk of money is going to be spent just outside this room. I think one of the things we need to watch for is really keeping an eye on how this money's spent, who's spending it, how the cities, the municipalities, the local governments are spending the money. And, you know, in anything else, I'm from Chicago. And in Chicago, there's always a certain finder's fee that you have to pay when you get a contract for city work. How is the money going to be spent? How much of a finder's fee is there going to be that has to be mixed in to get the contracts and the like? I think that's something we need to, you know, is that built in or is it just good old-fashioned graft? So I think that's something we need to look at, because if you have that much money going out the door, as we found out with the COVID relief bill, there was a fairly large amount of money that disproportionately went to people who didn't need it, whether it was unemployment benefits, that folks that didn't need it. There's always a certain amount of that goes with it. And I think as journalists, it's our job to sort of root these stories out, find out what's going on, and make sure that your money as taxpayers is spent as efficiently as possible. Because we've neglected our highways and roads and bridges and infrastructure and grid system for 40, 50 years. And every penny that Congress passed that's coming out of your paychecks needs to be put back into asphalt and rebar and concrete and all the things that these folks are going to be doing here in the next several years. So it needs to be spent. It needs to be spent wisely. It needs to be spent for the best possible bang for the buck. And to her point, it needs to be spent equitably. Folks, it doesn't just need to be spent in, you know, the nice communities that I'm familiar with, Highland Park, Wilmette, or Winnetka around Chicago. It needs to be spent in other communities and in other places where there are needs, and that is just as deserved as the folks up in the high rent district.
Well said.
Something that I'm really interested in reading more about, seeing more research about, is how the growth of the logistics and transportation industry, obviously fueled by the pandemic, will affect the communities they're in. An area I've gotten more interested in during the pandemic is the Inland Empire. And I'm curious what the boom in logistics growth out there, which was already growing pre-pandemic, how that looks out there in terms of job diversity, how that looks in terms of changes to the regional economy, and what that means for the people there. Are there more jobs for them there? Are those jobs, you know, considered good jobs? Are those sustainable jobs? And how does that, does an industry that is becoming the major industry of a region really affect the makeup of what happens there? That's something I'm very interested in. Something that is maybe more related to my older beat is drone deliveries. I'm curious to see how much further that gets developed, how FAA rules contribute to that, and what that means for folks maybe in last mile delivery. Does that change jobs? Does that not? And those are kind of the main things I'm interested in seeing.
Good ones to track. Sarah?
I think just personally, I'm very interested in how companies reacted to the supply chain crisis. You know, I don't know if everybody remembers, but at Christmas we were really worried that our kids weren't going to have toys under the tree because all the shelves were going to be empty, and of course that didn't play out. And companies actually had like a gangbuster quarter. Retail companies, you know, they somehow managed to plan ahead for this. So I'd love sort of like just some investigation into how companies were able to sort of turn on a dime to make sure that they were able to get the cargoes that they had planned for despite 100 ships being backed up at the ports. At LA and Long Beach, and now, you know, we're seeing, of course, the economy's taking a bit of a turn, but the consumer is still strong, but yet we're seeing companies saying you know, they don't have the right inventories for what people want, and, you know, they're not able to sort of pivot in the same way a quarter later. So I'm interested in how companies were able to react so quickly and sort of save the day through the end of the year, and then how that situation's changing for them now. And I guess just in terms of inequality, I'm very interested, we have written about some of the maritime shipping laws and these anti-immunity protections that freight alliances have. And I guess it really plays into the equality angle, because we heard from a lot of fruit growers, or just sort of like small to medium-sized businesses in developing countries, they were no longer suddenly to afford 20,000 spot rate for their containers when it used to be 2,000 a few months ago. You know, those shipping rates, as soon as the supply chain went haywire, they were able to charge multiples of what they were previously to ship their goods. So it really created a situation where bigger companies were able to absorb those costs, smaller companies, developing nations weren't. So what the impact of that was and what it will continue to be.
All good stuff. As I said earlier, one of the great benefits of getting three very talented panelists is there's no shortage of things to talk about. Does anybody have a question?
Hi, thank you very much. Whoa, that's loud. Just curious, one of the characteristics of a lot of logistics activity is that you've got this local pain that's felt for the global gain, what happens in the broader economy. And in terms of your role in the public discourse, how do you think covering supply chain is different than other stories that you've covered? Thinking of that whole aspect of local pain versus global gain.
That's a great question. Does anybody want to take that?
I guess I'll start. It's much more complicated. And everything with supply chain, I've found, is a trade-off. It's never 100% win for one side or the other. It's 60-40, it's 51-49. I've been telling a couple people a story about a story that I've been covering in my hometown of Chicago about a local dispute that's really bubbled up the last couple of years. It's about this historic Donald Ross golf course. And if anyone who knows about golf, Donald Ross was a great golf course designer 100 and some odd years ago. But the golf course has fallen into disrepair, and it's got back taxes doing all this stuff. So a developer bought it, and he wants to turn it into a logistics center. But of course, the folks in the community who have had this golf course, that none of them played, don't want this, you know, 100 or so acres of nice, pristine golf course turned into a logistics center. But here's the rub. The folks in this community, it happens to be, by the way, near a rail line for the UP. So they're, you know, the land is very valuable. But here's the other rub. All of the folks in that community, I'm sure 99.9% of them are Amazon Prime members. And they all want their stuff with 12 or 24-hour delivery, as all of us do. So it becomes a trade-off. And there's a huge not-in-my-backyard contingent that is bubbled up in this community, and they have every right to protest and everything, but there's been protest, and there's been a guy got arrested at a city council meeting one night when they allowed folks to come in and give public comment, and it was quite a show. And from a reporting standpoint, that's always good theater, but everything's a trade-off. I mean, you can't expand a highway or a railroad yard or do something without impacting the local community. It's for the greater good of the country, but it's always a trade-off, and it's never 100 or 0 or 99 to 1. It's always 51 to 49 or 52 to 48. And we have to realize that as reporters, that, you know, I included in the story the protesters, and I reached out to the, you know, the folks who were protesting and raising all sorts of difficulty. And, you know, they got their part of the story. They got in the story, of course. But I come at the stories from a transportation angle, and from the aspect of, you know, life moves on, the supply chain's got to deliver these goods, and this land is very valuable, and the golf course sort of fell into disrepair, and times change.
That's a great example. Samantha, Sarah, any thoughts? Balancing the global with the local pain?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a challenge. I mean, one thing once I started covering supply chains during the pandemic was just the complexity and how much there is difference, there is nuance by every industry. So every story I would do, I would call as many experts as possible. I'm trying to understand all of the different steps of this to make sure that I can adequately explain to readers what's going on. Usually our focus is a little more regional. We've tried in recent years to kind of show how issues affect specifically California, maybe the West is kind of the larger sphere. So we try to make sure that we're balancing, you know, this is what's going on nationally and here's how it's the same or different as you see here in California. So it's just been in terms of how to balance it, it's just been a lot of reporting, a lot of talking to experts such as yourselves.
Yeah, and I think that we try and humanize broad topics. Like a big one now, obviously, is inflation. And of course, it wasn't all driven by the supply chain issues, but it definitely partly was. And so, you know, we will try and cover that as a big macro issue. I mean, we'll cover the figures when they come out. We'll try and break them down and explain which categories of, used cars are driving inflation or whatever the factors are that are driving it, you know, or food inflation. I mean, it's a huge issue for us right now, and it's a global issue, and it's causing countries now to resort to food protectionism, like banning exports of chickens or vegetable oil in developing countries. So, you know, it kind of creates this domino effect, and then we'll always just, again, try and step back and do pieces that explain, like, okay, what does this mean for people on the ground? You know, maybe we do it visually with a photo essay, or we talk to people and try and come up with, like, a common theme of how the pain's being felt. But we do try and, I suppose, humanize it to kind of compare, like, this sort of global, broad issue that we're all feeling, and then sort of, write something that's sort of anecdote-driven that is a real look at, you know, something everyone can relate to about how this pinch is being felt, I suppose.
It's a good question, Clarence, and it's making me think about this term complexity and the supply chain. I was just thinking about how difficult it is to cover some of these issues without writing an entire book. When you bring up an issue like global supply chain and local pain, I have an impulse to want to explain all of the different multi-jurisdictional complications that arise, negotiating local, state, county, federal ordinance, regulations, all kinds of things. And there's in an age when you're supposed to, I don't have my phone here, but fit it all on one screen, it's not that easy. So how do you guys negotiate the complexity of the issue? I mean, I know it's an impossible task on some level, but what's your thought process? What tools do you use to prioritize and get the germ of factual truth out there without, for lack of a better term, dumbing it down and not showing the necessary complexity?
One bite at a time. Just one bite at a time. One paragraph, one sentence, one story at a time. And the advantage I think that I have is that I write for a transportation-centric publication. I work for a transportation-centric broadcasting entity that just people who I talk to, they get it. So, I don't have to, quote, dumb it down too much because I'm writing to the men and women in this room who I believe have a basic knowledge of what I'm talking about. I don't need to put a paragraph in when I'm doing a story about container volumes. I don't have to put a line in there explaining what a TEU is because everybody knows what it is. So I don't have to use that column inch space to do that. When I talk about operating ratio for a transportation company, I don't need to spell it all out because everybody who's on that side of the business understands what, you know, a publicly traded company's operating ratio is and how it affects profit and loss. So I don't need to do that. So that's an advantage I have. But what I try to do is when I'm doing a story is I try to get, as I'm sure my friends here do, I try to talk to as many people as I can and find the common nub of the story, whatever it is, and then start to build it from there, build it from the top down. Okay, this is the truth in the first paragraph or the first couple sentences, and then start to build the bottom of it. And that's the way I go about it. But I think that when I'm starting a story, I come at from the premise I've got to get several people to A, confirm to me that this is actually happening, or the data backs it up, that I've got the data to back up what I'm going to say. And once I get that, then I can start to sprinkle up and backfill it from there.
So on some level, it's good old-fashioned reporting. Get out
there. Oh yeah,
there
and some things don't change. Yeah, I mean it's shoe leather. It's making telephone calls. It's sending emails. It's reading reports, looking at some of the material that I get sent, trying to not just read the executive summary of it, but also going as deep in it as I can, knowing full well that while I may have a 150-page report about NOx emissions or something, I'm only going to get 800 or 900 words. So I really have to distill it down and get the most pertinent 3 or 4 facts into the story and then support the data with either quotes from the story itself or from the report itself or an independent expert who can validate it for me and say, yeah, this is really true.
Sarah, you're producing your own work constantly, but you're also commissioning stories to others. How does this notion of negotiating complexity, reporting on it, factor into your own work and when you commission a story to others?
Yeah, definitely when I'm speaking to a reporter about a story idea, I mean, I just try and just keep hitting, every 5 sentences of our conversation end, let's just keep it simple, let's just keep it short, because obviously this is, especially supply chains, I mean, what could be sort of more convoluted and have more complexity to it, I suppose. Let's just keep it simple. I mean, I say that probably 100 times a day, and that's, again, not to dumb it down, but as Dan was saying, I mean, you just, you want to hit your point and back it up and have all that sort of nuance and whatnot in there, but, there's only so much people can handle, and, I mean, in my ideal world, for our news stories, we'd have probably, we'd put in a strict rule of, 500 words, which to all of you who maybe consume most of the news on the phone, that might be sort of like 3 scrolls of your phone. I feel like that's sort of my limit for reading the news, and so we don't want to totally lose people. And if you can't say it in 500 words, there's a problem in most cases with news, but that's difficult to do. And the other thing that we use a lot at Bloomberg, we call it size and scope, and it's sort of, we hit you over the head with what does this mean in sort of the simplest terms. So, if we were talking about the ports of LA and Long Beach, we would say something like, which handle 40% of imports into the US or is the number one gateway to the US from China, just to give people a sense, of exactly the kind of volumes that we're talking about and sort of... Just make it easier, I suppose, for people to understand, visualize, I suppose, what we're talking about, the importance of a place like these ports, for instance, who, to the average reader would just, really have no clue.
Sometimes for me, it comes down to how much information do I have? Is this actually 2 separate stories so that I can hit all of these different topics in a way that is going to be nuanced, going to be complete, and is going to resonate with readers, and they don't have to read through, 2,000 words, which is not going to be possible online. That's something that we've tried to do with some of our supply chain coverage. We start with one story, and we say, okay, well, what could it fit in there, and how could that maybe be its own story, and how could we tell that in a way that we didn't with the last story? And it's sort of been a sort of evolving process of, okay, that point was really interesting. Maybe we can expand that and humanize it by, say, talking to someone who had been on a container ship for months and months trying to get into the port. Does that get at the issue of, what that's like out there and also kind of get at a larger idea of what's happening out there? So it's sort of a how much do you have? What are the most important parts of that? And can those be separated into different stories?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate all the panelists. Wonderful talent up there for writing about our industry. A couple of terms came to the public's awareness during the Chinese shutdown and the beginning of the COVID situation, and that was supply chain and chassis and a few other things like that. I read Transport Topics.
Oh, yeah. All right.
I read JOC and all of the other industry periodicals. And then I started watching some of the news channels, and not so much the 24-hour opinionated news, but more the 1-hour or 30-minute news anchor type channels. And I hear things like the ATA said that there's 80,000 truckers short. And then you hear the reporter say that the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are backed up because there's 80,000 truckers short of 80,000 drivers. And then you hear that there's a chassis shortage, when in reality maybe the chassis are sitting out 3 to 4 to 5 times out at the customer longer than expected, because customers went from a JIT inventory to a just in case, but they didn't have the space to put everything, so now everything's on wheels. And then you hear that there's not enough longshoremen and that's why the ships are out at sea. When in reality, I think the longshoremen's highest point was about 8% a drop in labor working the vessels. You hear about 53% appointments going untouched, when in reality there are hours of service and time logs, and owner operators have an inability to slip seat a different driver into his truck for the second shift, and half of the receivers aren't open on the second shift. But you don't hear about those things on the news. What you read in your periodicals is factual, you know, bullet point information, and yet what you hear, what America hears, is totally different. And it makes me wonder, okay, I'm listening to what is said on ABC, NBC, CBS, and some of the other networks, and none of it is legitimate. It has little bits of legitimacy, but none of it is legitimately the problem. And then I start reading about Brexit, or I start hearing about Taiwan, and I'm thinking, all right, if they're that inaccurate with us, how inaccurate are they with the rest of the news?
Okay.
And do they come to you guys for some of their...
Sometimes.
Some of their content.
But having been on that side of the street, and I worked the general assignment beat for 15 years, and I'm glad I'm not there anymore, it is very hard to be a subject matter expert at the level that I think the three of us are at if you're a general assignment reporter, because... one day you're working on a school board issue about resource officers in the schools, whether they should be or shouldn't be. The next day you're working on another story. They've moved the Uber lanes at LAX, and you're reporting on that story. And the next, if you're at a network, you're covering a political campaign for 2 weeks, and then you're sent off to Ukraine, and you have to become a subject matter expert on that. I admire the work that folks in that sector have to do, but it's like you're being fired out of a cannon every day in terms of getting up to speed on the type of stuff that you're doing. Whereas with what I do now, at this point in my career, I don't have to worry about the school board meetings or the war in Ukraine, except for how it relates to oil prices or how it relates to the supply chain. So I give those folks credit. They've got a nearly impossible job to do to fill the time, and I'm not even talking about the cable networks, because that's a whole nother area of strangeness. But they're good, but you can't expect them to be exactly, knowing all everything about it, because it's impossible.
Well, I'll hear them talk about a truck driver sitting for 6 hours, and they interview the trucking company owner, and it might be an owner that I happen to know. And it might be a trucking company that's got maybe 20 drivers and not 350 drivers. And the driver may have sat for 6 hours, and it could have been anybody's fault.
No, I
spent a lot of years in trucking. But that's the story that hits the news.
Of course. Truckers,
not a truck driver from this one company, truckers wait 6 to 8 hours. Well, the data shows that the truckers are waiting, 90 minutes,
But here's the situation. That newscast that you're watching, ABC, CBS, NBC, whatever it is, or your local station, Channel 5 here, Channel 7 here, it is nothing more than just a snapshot. It is not the definitive word. It is a snapshot on what's taking place in your community, in the country, in the world at that moment. That's all it is. It's a snapshot.
I think it's
leaving a wrong impression.
I'd like to hear from a couple other people. Questions in the back.
So today, obviously, with the web interface, you have a lot more data. Were there any stories or maybe segments of readers that really surprised you? Issues they grabbed onto, something you wrote that got way more views than you were expecting, especially during the pandemic and especially with all the supply chain focus. Was there anything that you saw in the data that surprised you?
Probably for us, we're a data-driven news service. Basically, Bloomberg rents these terminals out that have all this wonderful data in it that people from Wall Street to central bankers use to make decisions or trade on. And so I think for us, you know, we have this trove of data. It's almost too overwhelming to even know where to start, you know, when you log on to one. And we just started using a lot of the data that was actually on the terminal and looking at some of that. Again, speaking with researchers, people at universities, we started to actually think like, oh, well, you know, we have a lot of these statistics at our fingertips. We just didn't know whether to look, like where to look before or how to interpret them. And so I think we've been able to, you know, we get probably the most feedback for our newsletter, which has 75,000 subscribers. It's called Supply Lines. It used to be called Terms of Trade. And once the supply chain crisis really exploded a couple years ago, we changed the name. You know, for us, that's a really hugely popular newsletter because there's a lot of people who are just super interested in this, and we use a lot of charts in it, and we, you know, we get it from outside sources, but we've added a lot to our terminal as well. So it's actually really interesting. One of the most popular features, I think, from it is, you know, and I think there are resources online where you can get similar data, but we have a really stellar maps function, and so you can see every cargo ship in the world, where it is, what's on it, who's on it. And during the port of Long Beach, you know, back in January when there were more than 100 ships outside, it was just a really cool function to see like what was on its way, what was waiting out there. You can't capture it all with like a photo lens, even the most wide angle lens. But if you see it on that map function, you're thinking, oh my God, this is what's going on out there. And I think that really captures people's imaginations. I think we're all pretty visual, and that speaks a lot louder sometimes than 1,000 words, so.
It's a great point. I think one of the big resources, at least for me, and I think a lot of us can relate, is Johns Hopkins University had that COVID dashboard map that we could look at. And I think that in part ushered in a new era of data awareness. And I think, yes, absolutely. You can look at something and have a geospatial, global, situational awareness notion of where the global freight picture is in one snapshot, and then have the ability to click a node and go down and go deep is an extraordinary new frontier for journalism and for research. So I'm excited to follow that trend, to pick up on an earlier question. Samantha, did you have any thoughts on data?
Yeah, so we can see how many views stories get, and what's also really interesting is where those viewers are coming from. Are they coming from social media? Are they reading stories on Facebook, Twitter? You know, maybe they're coming through the LA Times Instagram and clicking through and finding the story. And stories that ended up really resonating with readers were stories about the Great Resignation, or the so-called Great Resignation. Why people were leaving their jobs, where they were going, what made them want to leave, and what would make them want to come back. And stories like that just, you know, they got huge amounts of viewership. People were looking at it from social, from Apple News, just huge amounts of viewers. And we thought that was really interesting. I mean, it was a trend that we were following, but it was clearly something that people wanted to read more. And so we looked at that and said, okay, how, with stories about this topic, can we better serve people and really explain what's going on, maybe explain what they themselves are seeing in their workplaces, and how this could look in the future?
Hi, thank you very much. I know that we're in an environment now where there are just two or three or some, you know, sometimes even one mega corporation or mega entity that dominates certain industries, and that's certainly true in our field, and I think it's true in your field as well. But being that you're the fourth pillar of democracy, you're in a special spot, right? So being that you're at three different levels, or you know, you serve kind of three different markets, I'm curious what level of independence and autonomy you're given to do research and to come up with whatever conclusions you come up with that may be inconvenient for certain parties, and what kind of resources are you given to do that, whether it's from home or a field. And the one industry that I haven't heard talked about much so far, I know we're still early, but we've heard about the ocean carriers and we've heard about warehouses, very good presentation this morning. But no one has mentioned the Class I railroads and their impact. And believe me, they are the elephant in the room. Have you done any research on them, or can you, or do you expect to?
I've been covering the whole, you know, Kansas City Southern, who are they gonna merge with, story since it broke, you know, more than a year ago, and God, I can't tell how many different stories I've done on that. You know, I covered the whole problem that UP had out here last summer when they shut things down. So I follow the railroads. It's not my primary area of responsibility, but I follow them and keep a pretty close watch on them. And they're like anything else. They, you know, they've got a good corporate PR department that, you know, wants to put the best possible spin on what they're doing, but they're having problems in terms of, you know, moving things, because like the trucking industry, like the point that was raised earlier about the shortage of truck drivers, there's a shortage of conductors and engineers because of the fact that it's a difficult life. You know, you're on the road for long periods of time. They get it, they're well compensated. They've got a great retirement, but it's a difficult job. It's a difficult life to do. I follow them, but you know, with regards to the other point, I'll just hit this real quick and then wrap it up. All my stuff has to go through an editor. I mean, everything that each one of us writes has to go through an editor, and I have to be able to justify everything I put on my terminal. Everything I write has to, you know, I have to be able to back it up and tell my editor, that's where the quote came from. You want to read the quote? Here's the transcript. So it's just, you know, basic blocking and tackling in terms of the reporting, and that's one of the things why I think that from a standpoint of just solid reporting, I think that the type of work that the three of us are doing, it's straight down the middle. It doesn't contain a slant one way or the other. It's not left, it's not right. It's not screaming, talking cable heads. It's the best available information that we can put together in the story at that date. And when I push the send button, the story may change in an hour and a half, but at that moment that I pushed the send button and sent it to my editor, or my editor published it, it was the best available information that I could get at that time.
And just to follow up on that, like Dan was saying, my stuff goes through an editor. After my editor goes through those stories, it goes through a copy editor who not only looks for grammatical issues, but also makes sure that things make sense. You know, I looked at your math, and in this point, this was the percentage, and this is the layer percentage, but there's a missing unit. Did you make a mistake here? Or, you know, in other cases, they'll look at it and say, this part doesn't make sense. You guys maybe need to go back and talk to the editor and see what's going on there, because I don't understand this point. Our stories go through a lot of different layers of editing, of scrutiny, and in terms of outside influence, our owners of the paper don't have any sort of sway over what we write. There's a firewall between the editorial side and the business side, which sells ads. You know, there's no sort of influence there. Just in terms of story ideas, it's what myself and my editor deem are, okay, you know, these are important topics, these are things that readers want to read, you know, we're going to go forward with a story. But there's no sort of interference from the money-making parts of the paper or from the owners.
And yeah, I guess that also rings true at Bloomberg. You know, the sales folks, there's like a wall between us. We can't fraternize or share contacts, or, you know, they can't give us a story idea tip that they heard from a paper they saw on a client's desk. I mean, it's just, it doesn't happen. And, you know, we do have our opinion columnists, and, you know, Michael Bloomberg will write his own editorials sometimes. We have an editorial board. Those are clearly marked. Every single one of those has it in the headline. Opinion, the person's name. You know, it's clear. And editorially, I mean, sometimes we have so much independence that, you know, as an editor, I hit send on a story every single time. I'm like, whew, like, you know, I mean, I trust in the story, but you think, what a responsibility, right, to have, to be just, you know, sending this information out into the world. And I take it with the utmost seriousness and just making sure the facts are straight, but also the tone of the story. And I think, you know, bringing up a really good point that someone might be pointing a finger at someone else, blaming them for the supply chain crisis. It's the drivers, it's the terminal operators, it's the carriers. But at the end of the day, you know, it's definitely a domino effect. So just trying to make sure that nuance is there, and whatever someone's telling us, not blindly writing it, but really trying to write that nuance into it, that it's not as simple as it might, as this person's making it sound. So that's part of, to not appear to be editorializing or taking sides, that is part of our jobs. And we try and do it right, and I think we get it right, hopefully 99% of the time, 98, I don't know, most of the time.
I could be up here for another hour, but I am sensitive to the fact we've got a whole lineup of exciting research panels for the rest of the afternoon, so I'd just like to invite everybody in the room to put their hands together for two reasons. This excellent panel, but also the great work that these three media professionals to my right are bringing out every day and every week. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of Mobility Matters. It was my distinct pleasure to sit down with three leading media voices to discuss the importance of conveying supply chain priorities through the Fourth Estate. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes of Mobility Matters, where we engage other leading voices in the trade and transportation sector. This episode of Mobility Matters was brought to you by the Pacific Southwest University Region Transportation Center.
Additional episodes of Mobility Matters are available on major podcast platforms like Spotify, Audible, iHeartRadio, and Amazon Music, and also online at nntw.org/mobilitymatters.